Welcome to the Agency in Focus, NASA, sponsored by Leidos. Now, here's your host, Tom Temin.
NASA has been pursuing the commercial space launch industry to get astronauts to the space station. But for deeper space exploration, the moon and beyond, the agency has since 2011 been working on its own heavy lift system, known as Space Launch System, SLS. It's an amalgam of existing and new products and technology. I spoke with Bill Hill, NASA's Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems and Development. He's no newcomer to getting big things into space.
I've been with NASA since 1994, and previously I was one of the support contractors in the area.
So in some ways you've seen the kind of end of NASA having heavy lift capability and now the resurgence of it.
Pretty much, yeah. I had the good fortune of being the shuttle director here in D.C. for the last 21 missions. And worked since STS-27, which was the second one after return to flight after Challenger. I just worked on the shuttle system initially in safety and then as a program management type.
Talking about the SLS, that is the rocket carrier that will take the Orion spacecraft astronauts back into space. How closely related is that to the systems that got the shuttle aloft, and how much of it is brand new from scratch design?
Well, one of the things we chose to do early on when we first stood up the Space Launch System was to make utilization of 16 space shuttle main engines that we had left over from the shuttle program. That really took a lot of program risk out of our development because, as you may know, in other vehicle developments like the space shuttle, the hard part was getting the main propulsion system, the main engines up and running reliably. So we decided to leverage that. We're using four old shuttle main engines, which we call RS-25s. We use four of those. The difference between shuttle and the space launch system is that the shuttle had the engines mounted to the actual orbiter, where on the Space Launch System, we're actually mounting the engines at the base of the what would have been an external tank in the space shuttle program. So we have what we call a core stage with a liquid oxygen tank, liquid hydrogen tank, and then an engine section, which will house all the main propulsion system, plumbing, and thrust vector control for four RS-25 engines.
So in some ways, it looks a little bit like the old rockets that had the Saturn V engines on them.
That is correct. It looks much more like that. We're also using two 5-segment solid rocket boosters strapped on, very similar to what Shuttle had 4 segments. We leveraged what was done in the Constellation program and added the 5th segment to get a little bit extra boost. So those will come off 2 minutes into flight, very similar to what Shuttle did. And give us about 7 million pounds of thrust off the pad.
And when the program runs out of the RS-25s, because you said there's 16 of them, so that's 4 launches.
Yes.
Then what?
Well, we already have a production restart contract in place with Aerojet Rocketdyne. They're busily working on how to reduce the cost of these engines because the shuttle engines were built to be reusable, and we're not reusing them, not reusing the core stage. So we're trying to make sure we have, that we can actually afford to build these things. We're looking at 3D printing of parts, and we're going through a test program. The initial contract is for 6 engines, and then we'll have a follow-on contract for the actual production once we get that in place.
And just as an aside, what types of parts can be 3D printed? Because I think of these things as having super-duper exotic alloys and materials in them.
Some of them are, but some things like our oxygen, what we call a POGO accumulator, it basically takes the fluctuation of the liquid as it bounces as we go uphill. It takes it out before it feeds into the main engines. But the POGO accumulator, we've already done that. Off the top of my head, I can't remember how big it is. It's a little bit bigger than a basketball, I believe. And we've built that. There's a lot of capability to build parts that were machined and have intricate manual workmanship to build them. We can build with laser or 3D printing and build up all that complexity inside.
We're speaking with Bill Hill. He's Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development at NASA. And what is the test schedule for all this? As you develop all these parts, at some point they are integrated, bolted together. Give us a status report.
Well, we're constantly testing the RS-25 engines, the new parts as they come off the line. We've already done the Pogo accumulator. We've built brand new flight computer control, what we call the main engine controllers. We've already built those and tested those, and they're ready to go. We had some problems with the old. We had the controllers from the old engines, but they were some of the parts were obsolete, and we were concerned about getting through. So we've adapted what was being built for the Constellation program for the J2X engine, and adapted that for the RS-25, and we've tested that, and it's up and running, ready to go. From a test standpoint, as we build the core stage, we're going to take that to the Stennis Space Center in Mississippi. We've built a test stand there, and we're going to test the entire core for some level of time, just to make sure all the plumbing works and we can fill it and drain it and all that before we take it to the Cape and integrate it with the rest of the vehicle.
And just another detail, when you test fire an RS-25, that doesn't consume it as a flight would. You can fire it more than once. In other words, you can test it and then put it in the rocket for actual use?
That is correct. And in fact, when we test the core stage, we'll have the four flight engines mounted on that. And once we get the core stage tested at Stennis Space Center, we'll take it to the Kennedy Space Center and integrate it. We'll just leave the engines on it.
But the testing takes place statically on the ground as long as nobody stands on the wrong end of it.
Correct. And then for the Orion vehicle, we're going through, and for the core stage, we're going through a lot of structural testing. We're doing Space Launch System structural testing at the Marshall Space Flight Center. And we're in the process of doing, even today, the structural testing of the Orion capsule, the launch abort system, and the service module at Lockheed Martin in Denver.
Sure, and for the SLS itself, continuing on that one, there is also a ground program, a whole new ground system necessary to test that.
Well, yeah, we built up an old test stand, we call it B2, at the Stennis Space Center. We had to increase the height capability so we could put the actual core stage in there. And all the plumbing and so forth that is needed to get the liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen into the core stage. But that, I was actually down there last week, and that was looking very good. It's ready to go. A few minor things, and we'll be ready to bring the core stage over once it's finished.
And you mentioned some of the electronics and the controllers for all of this. And I guess from your point of view, relative to the space shuttle program, it must look like you have supercomputers by comparison.
In some ways, we're still kind of restricted by, you know, radiation impacts and so forth. But we have a whole new avionics suite in the core stage with the space shuttle, with the external tank. All the electronics were in the actual orbiter. Now the core stage is basically a launch vehicle unto itself. It's got to be able to fly by itself. We have plans to potentially fly the Europa Clipper autonomously with the Space Launch System, so we wouldn't have an Orion, for instance, to fly with it. So it's got to operate it on its own. It's got its own computer system, and we're in the process of developing that software at the Marshall Space Flight Center today.
And when you add up the SLS, just give us a brief idea of some of the dimensions and specs, because it's really big, isn't it?
It's about 212 feet tall for the core stage. Once you add the Orion, and we also have an interstage, initially an interim cryopropulsion system that acts as a second stage to give us the performance we need to do a translunar injection. 322 feet.
Bill Hill is Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development at NASA. In part two of the interview, Hill describes the work going into Orion, the new crew vehicle that will sit atop the giant launch system. I'm Tom Tenen.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
While NASA works on its Space Launch System's heavy rocket, as we heard detailed in the last hour, it's also hard at work on perfecting Orion, the new capsule that the rocket will lift. In part two of my interview with Bill Hill, NASA's Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development, he describes details of Orion and also of the orbiting relay station known as the Gateway.
And we look at it as a staging area. It'll give us the capability to do telerobotics to the lunar surface and do on-orbit experimentation, scientific experiments, and so forth. It's a different environment. It's a higher radiation environment that you would have on the space station. Very similar, though, in that, you know, it is a zero-G platform with no gravity. But we're looking forward to being able to build that out with our commercial partners and our international partners, and as well as some of the contributions that we're putting in now.
And the Orion, with up to six people and having a galley and all of these other things, it sounds like an amalgam of what might have been learned from the space shuttle program and from the International Space Station, as well as maybe as far back as Apollo.
Yeah, all those lessons learned are being integrated and put into the Orion space capsule, and it's going to be quite the platform for transporting humans from here to the moon and back.
What is the timeline for all of this coming together, the SLS and the Orion?
Right now, we're targeting a launch of what we're calling Exploration Mission 1 in the spring of 2020. We're pulling all that together. We still are working with our European space agency partners to get the service module. They've been building that over the last few years, and we should get delivery of that early in September, so we can integrate that with Orion, and then getting the core stage up and running by this time next year we'll be into our green run test at Stennis.
The service module is part of Orion, though, not part of SLS.
That is correct. It's very similar to what Apollo had. You might remember the Apollo 13 issue. That was an issue in the service module. But Apollo, you know, Orion, like Apollo, will have the crew module as well as the service module.
And how big is Orion relative to, say, a school bus?
It's smaller than a school bus. It's probably like a big SUV. It's 5 meters in diameter, so that's a little more than 15 feet. And it's got a lot of room. It's Apollo was, I think, 3.4 or 3.7 meters in diameter. So it's a little bit wider at the base and has a lot more capabilities. But it's very similar in design with the service module. We also have a launch abort system that'll be able to extract the crew module in the event of an issue going uphill. And that's very much like the Apollo system, although ours, from a noise standpoint, is so much louder and imparts so much greater energy as it jettisons or as it comes off, that we have to put what we call an ogive or an area around the actual crew module to protect it a little bit from the noise.
In other words, the acoustic pressure can actually damage it.
Yes.
Bill Hill is Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development at NASA. I'm Tom Temin.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.
We're speaking with Bill Hill, Deputy Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development at NASA. Bridging from, you know, lunar exploration, which we've done and which people can do for 21 days or so, what about Mars? What's going on to develop simultaneously this someday capability, maybe a couple of decades off, maybe not, to get people really deep in space?
Well, we're looking at this as a stepping stone approach. You know, we all say that we haven't been back to the, or that we've been to the moon, but we've only been to a small part. And there's actually some areas of the moon that we really need to go take another look at, like the poles, to see if there really is ice there that could support a economic development or an economic zone. We got to go back and do that. But looking toward Mars, our initial plan with the Gateway was very similar. We were going to go up and prove out some procedures and capabilities in the lunar vicinity before projecting out to Mars. And our plan initially was to develop a Mars transport, a Mars class transport that would take our folks out to an orbit around Mars. And we're looking at things like, you know, can we set up a staging area very similar to Gateway, either in the Martian orbit or excuse me, on one of the Martian moons, Phobos or Deimos. So we're looking to have that capability and those lessons and experiences to project ourselves into the solar system.
But right now, the SLS and Orion then is really lunar-focused.
It's lunar-focused today. It will give us the capability to lift the type of masses we're going to need to get to Mars. And we will evolve to a much heavier lift capability, initially around 100 metric tons. Actually, we'll probably be in the 120 metric ton area. And then we'll evolve to 130 or more metric ton lift capability. And that's lift off the surface. We still need the capability in space, what we call the translunar or trans Mars injection capability, which would be an upper stage. It would give us that extra push to get out there.
And then you have the human life sustainment challenge, too.
That is correct. And we're in the process of, initially with Gateway, we're going to leverage what we used on the International Space Station. And we'll continue to use the space station as a test bed for developing environmental control and life support systems to try to increase the reliability of those systems and lessen the overall overhead of operating those systems in space.
Now, the SLS had controversy back in the early part of the decade when it was proposed and costed out, and Elon Musk said he could do it cheaper, and there were all these studies, some of which were publicly released, some not. Do you get the sense, you know, as a longtime NASA guy, that the government and the administrations and Congress are finally of one mind, as much as that's possible in this country, behind the SLS Orion complex and program?
Well, I think today we have great support both in Congress and within the administration. You know, we look at it as a and proposition. We need everybody. We need all those capabilities that SpaceX and the others can provide. In fact, we're getting ready to start purchasing services from SpaceX and Boeing to get crew to the International Space Station. It's, you know, it's a broad portfolio, and we need everybody. We need everybody to be able to do their part. You don't necessarily need a full-up SLS for everything we do in space, so we can leverage some of the smaller lift capabilities of our commercial partners.
And the science and the engineering and the program management for this are taking place at several NASA centers and locations, which has always been the case. Does it feel like, from an IT standpoint, all of that is better integrated than it might have been in earlier years?
Oh, yeah, I think it's much better integrated. The best thing that, you know, I travel a lot to the centers, and the best thing I have found is I can just go get on the Wi-Fi at any center and just be like I'm at my desk. It is much improved. It's very secure, and it enables us to be able to pretty much work from anywhere.
And how many people do you feel, or do you count, I should say, are involved in one way or another with SLS and with Orion?
Well, between SLS, Orion, and then the ground systems that we're building to support the launch and launch preparation of those vehicles, We're somewhere in the 8,000 to 9,000 range, both civil servant and contractors.
Probably it's about 10% NASA and 90% contractors. That's the old rule of thumb, or is it more NASA?
Well, it's more like 15 to 20% NASA, and then the rest contractors.
And how does it feel, relative to the space shuttle days? You were there for, as you mentioned, the last 21 launches, and so you saw the apex and kind of the wind down.
Yeah, and it's very similar. We're a lot of the folks, probably half the folks that are working it today, either SLS Orion or the ground systems, work shuttle. We've got a lot of good relationships. We've built new relationships. There was some different talents that we needed. The shuttle program primarily was operational, so we had an operational mindset or culture. Because we were developing some things from scratch, it takes a different skill set. And so we had to kind of pull the two skill sets together, the operational side as well as the development side. And we got the best of the best out of both of those, and I believe we're going to have a good outcome.
So it sounds like there are second acts possible.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And if you look at SLS with the engines and the boosters, it's pretty much some of the same teams, same contractors. We've worked among ourselves. We've worked probably 30, 40 years together.
On that point, and with the 8,000 or 9,000 people involved, is there new blood coming into this whole area? Because it's not developing apps and it's not programming something in Java. It's really space exploration and space engineering. Is it drawing in a new generation of people?
Yeah, and NASA being a great brand and we garner goodwill from that brand, and folks still want to come to work for NASA, and a lot come in through our contractors initially because that's where they can get the hands-on experience, and then migrate over as positions open up. On the NASA side, we're also trying to bring in a lot of interns during the summer to expose them to our environment, as well as bring new people in, fresh folks right out of college. We've got to really kind of bolster our bench because some of us are getting up there in age, and we need to be able to go retire someday.
Bill Hill is NASA's Associate Administrator for Exploration Systems Development. There's much more to the interview. We'll post it in its entirety at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. Subscribe to all of our interviews at iTunes or Podcast One. I'm Tom Temin.
Thank you for listening to Agency in Focus NASA, sponsored by Leidos on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. The entire program can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Search Agency in Focus.
This year, NASA celebrates its 60th anniversary. That's six decades of important work and reaching new heights.
And we have liftoff.
At Leidos, the team of IT experts, engineers, and scientists that support NASA are exceptionally honored to enable more missions for the offices and directorates that come together to conduct deep space exploration, advance human spaceflight, and encourage the world to think beyond the horizon. See a message from the team at Leidos.com/NASA.